Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Susan C. Ball. Dr. Ball received her medical degree from the Medical College of Pennsylvania and trained in internal medicine at Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse, New York. She has worked as a clinician caring for patients with HIV and AIDS for over 20 years. She is associate professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College and assistant director of the Birnbaum Unit Center for Special Studies and AIDS Care Center at New York's Presbyterian Hospital. She recently published an extraordinary and moving memoir about her work with AIDS patients called Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Changed from Doom to Hopeful. It was published by Cornell University Press, ILR Imprint, and I'm speaking to Susan Ball by phone from Maine, where she is traveling. Dr. Susan Ball, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tish, for having me.
Now, I want to ask you this. When you were studying medicine and contemplating your career, did you have any idea that you'd become an AIDS HIV specialist? And how did you get into this?
No, in fact, you know, I became pre-med in college, and that was, you know, before HIV was even on the radar. The first cases were reported as a strange new illness in 1981. It didn't even have the name AIDS or HIV, and I just was finishing college at that point. So I was in medical school when the disease emerged, which was first related, was called gay-related immune deficiency, and then it became clear that more than just gay men had this disease, that women and people who use drugs and babies and all kinds of people could have it. And that's when the name AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, became used. And then the virus was discovered in about 1984. So for me, through medicine, my medical school, it was growing out there, but it wasn't something that I said when I first heard about it as, oh, I wanna do this. But as it became apparent that these patients were so ill and needed a lot of care and also presented in such a variety of different ways, so many different kinds of doctors were involved in taking care of patients with AIDS. In the beginning, you know, a dermatologist might see a patient with Kaposi sarcoma, or mm-hmm. a neurologist might see a patient who was having trouble walking, or an ophthalmologist, or a psychiatrist, or a pulmonologist. Really, every area of medicine was called to take care of these patients. Yeah. And on the other side of that was the fact that the patients themselves were often very isolated, and for a lot of reasons, and for a long time, and still, you know, there's still so much stigma and prejudice out there for people with HIV and AIDS. So those two aspects of the illness, I think, were ones that drew me toward wanting to do this work and to take care of people with HIV.
I know, you know, as I was telling you in some of our correspondence, I was in San Francisco during the heyday, if you want to call it that, of this epidemic, and it was such a scary disease. No one knew what was happening.
So
in 1992, it's when you began working at the AIDS Care Center called the Center for Special Studies. Tell us about those early years, and I know you were serving underserved and sometimes uneducated patients. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that really the early 90s. I mean, the book covers this period of time from the early 90s until the end of the century, really. That decade where we went from really having no treatment for HIV to having effective treatment and HIV becoming really a chronic illness from mm-hmm. what it was prior to having good medicine, which was really almost universally a fatal illness. So mm-hmm. it was terribly frightening for the patients. And initially, before we really knew how it was transmitted and what was causing it, there was, you know, sort of this general fear and almost paranoia about, should we touch these patients? Can we be in the same room with them? And some of those early fears, I think, penetrated out into society. I think that's why, you know, a young boy like Ryan White, who was a young hemophiliac kid who wanted to go to school in the late 80s, and he was diagnosed with HIV, and his school wouldn't let him be in the same school. They thought, oh, if he's in the same classroom, the other kids might get AIDS.
I remember that case. That was horrifying.
Yeah, it was terrible, and it really brought out, you know, at that point we knew very well how it was transmitted and how it wasn't transmitted, and that kind of stigma and fear really brought out some of the some of the worst biases in people. And to answer the other aspect of your question, you know, HIV is not just among white gay men who have, you know, a house on Fire Island, which is sometimes the stereotype. Because in our clinic, we saw definitely I would say even the majority of our patients came from socioeconomically disadvantaged places. So they came from lives of poverty, of lack of education. There was a lot of mental illness, psychiatric illness, people who had been involved with drugs or were in prison or people who had had violence in their past. So our group of patients, we did definitely have a cohort of gay men that we took care of, but a lot of our patients were other kind of people from the margins of society. And the people who really were so distinctly not the people that, how do I put this?
They were stereotyped.
The stereotype. And also the people kind of shunned, you know, and they didn't have so much of a voice. You know, they really needed our care, but they weren't able to mobilize their activists. You know, poor people are not very good at that, and that's why this illness really has settled now even into the places where there's more poverty. It's where you find more HIV.
And you know, in the early days when it was happening, no one understood anything about what was happening. And the scariest thing for many of us was Kaposi's sarcoma, seeing young men with all these bruises on their faces. And it was something that was previously only seen in elderly men in Greece, right? Wasn't that the...
That's right. Kaposi's sarcoma was previously known, you're right, in the Mediterranean basin. So elderly Greek men would get Kaposi's sarcoma, and they might get a few patches on their legs or something, but not these cases that we were seeing that you saw, you know, where these young men who'd been previously healthy suddenly were totally losing all their weight and were covered with spots. It just really, sometimes horrifically so. That was very, very frightening.
And you know what I've always wanted to ask somebody like you? They used to see Kaposi's sarcoma in elderly men in Greece. Is that because their immune systems were somehow compromised? What was the connection?
No, I think we know now subsequently that there's a relation for the Kaposi's sarcoma that we see in patients with HIV. There's usually a link with a herpes virus called HHV6, and so it's related to, there's some infectious or viral link to it, and a number of cancers out there are linked to viral etiologies, but I don't think the Greek men had immune deficiency, because there's also some endemic Kaposi's sarcoma in parts of Africa among children, and that is also not linked to the herpes virus. So I think they're different. There may be different viruses that are linked to those cancers in those regions, but it's not specifically linked to HIV.
I've often wondered about that. Now, I remember during those days, too, that in Africa, that the same symptoms of AIDS, they were calling it slim disease.
Exactly.
And I understand why, because I saw such weight loss in some of the men that I knew.
Yeah. That's in Africa. They were finding it. It really sort of came about at about the same time that they were, these communities in Central Africa and what was formerly Zaire, that was sort of the locus point. And there were whole communities where the young adults were coming down with this slim disease, you know, and usually what it meant was that they had just unremitting diarrhea and they couldn't keep weight on, and they lost weight and then they died. And so for a long time, because of just sort of the lack of infrastructure in terms of healthcare in those places, that was all it was known as, was slim disease. And eventually, by the mid-80s, it became clear that that was the manifestation of HIV and AIDS in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your book how AIDS brought out the worst in people in so many ways, including some medical professionals. To talk to us about that.
Well, it did. It brought out the worst and the best in that, you know, I think that those early days of stigma and fear, the frightening aspect of the disease and not knowing what it was or where it came from, you know, that could bring out that fear of taking care of patients. So you hear stories of the food service workers who would leave the tray outside the door, or the surgeon who didn't want to operate because he didn't want to get infected or have his operating room get infected. So in that sense, you know, I say it brought out the worst. And yet it also brought out the best, because there were people who, you know, were drawn to taking care of these patients, who recognized that these were people who really needed help and needed compassion if we couldn't provide treatment, but they needed support. And as I said earlier, it brought all kinds of different fields of medicine together and doctors who were seeing all these different kinds of cases. So it was really across the board. And, you know, we saw similar responses, sort of a microcosm of that with Ebola. You know, you saw people really frightened and really reacting, oh, I don't want to touch anything from Africa that might have Ebola on it, but and then eventually, you know, getting a grip on it and having a responsible public health response. Yeah. Obviously, Ebola is much more transmissible illness than HIV ever was.
Yeah. I remember the fear like it was just yesterday. Now, you also talk about how this disease put MDs on the forward edge of medicine and opened up new frontiers. To us about how exciting that was.
You know, I think in so much of medicine, there are algorithms and rules, and if the blood pressure is this, you use this drug, and if the oxygen saturation is this, you use this drug. And in the early days with HIV, there were no books, there were no textbooks, there were no real roadmaps. So a lot of what we did was, and how we functioned was based on our experiences, and then conferences and saying, oh, we had these patients and they all had PCP and this is how we treated them and this worked well, whereas this other treatment didn't work as well, and really trying to find our way in terms of what was going to work. It also prompted enormous gains in study of immunology and virology, so how the immune system works. Why is the immune system so overwhelmed by this infection? What's going on? Why are some people really sick who have HIV and others not sick? Mm-hmm. What's going on with that? And so we definitely don't have all the answers to all those questions, but we learned enormous amount such that we were able to, I say we, but the field was able to really develop some treatments that specifically targeted aspects of how that virus replicates so that we could give people treatments that would halt the replication cycle of the virus and halt its effect on the immune system and allow the immune system to recover. So really enormous advances that have been able to be translated into a lot of other aspects of medicine and other aspects of patient care. In terms, I'm thinking of hepatitis treatments have taken a step from the work that was done in HIV. And I think a lot of cancer therapy now is based a lot on gene and immune therapy. So there were really great strides made.
Yeah, I know. And you know what amazed me and probably everybody involved with AIDS was how many opportunistic invasions happened when the immune system broke down. No one knew that all this stuff would be the response.
Yeah, that was really, I remember so much in those early days and working with the house staff, the residents in the hospital, and really cautioning them, you know, to say, this patient has two T cells, so that's a very, very broken immune system. So they're just so vulnerable. So sometimes the patient could be going along, doing all right, and getting maybe recovering from some infection that we were dealing with, and then boom, overnight have something else terrible happen. And they could have, so often in medicine we say, you know, there's really only one diagnosis and that you try and make all the different symptoms and things coalesce under one diagnosis. But in HIV, I had to throw out those rules because they could have two or three opportunistic infections at a time. So they could have a variety of symptoms or lab abnormalities that were related to those different problems and different issues. So it could be, you know, you really had to be on your toes and not say, oh, they have this infection, that, you know, and put all your treatment directed toward that because they could have another infection as well, and you had to be mindful of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Susan C. Ball. We're talking about her extraordinary book about her work in the AIDS community over the past 20 years. It's called Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Care Changed from Doom to Hopeful. And, you know, I want to talk to you, too, about the one of the first drugs that was offered that had a little bit of hope to it, and that was AZT. To talk to us a little bit about that, how it helped the T cells.
Well, AZT, so many drugs in the mid and late 80s were hauled off the shelves that hadn't worked for in cancer studies, and but were out there and they knew they functioned in a certain way. So many drugs were brought back off the shelves to say, does this help with HIV? Can this drug work? And so AZT was one of those drugs. It's called a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. It's in that class of drugs. So it inhibits a certain step in the replication cycle of this particular virus. And in the studies that were done with AZT initially, it seemed that patients, the thing that we could measure at that time, we couldn't measure virus per se. We could only measure the immune response. We could measure the T cells. So in the group of patients who took AZT, their T cells went up a little. So that was interpreted to mean that the AZT was inhibiting the virus and the T cells were recovering. And in fact, that is what it did. But we learned very quickly that a single drug against HIV is going to be quickly result in the virus becoming resistant to that drug.
Mm-hmm.
The virus can change very quickly and become resistant to a single drug. And so even though AZT was initially greeted with, like, finally we have some drugs, this is great, you know, everybody mm-hmm. should take AZT, it became quickly apparent that AZT was not going to be the miracle drug. And it also had a lot of side effects. So patients often were taking it with very, very advanced disease, and it might help for a couple of weeks, and then patients would go on to succumb to their AIDS. And so it turned around and got a very bad rap that, you know, it had side effects and it didn't help people live any longer. So AZT was then looked at as, oh, this is just something the drug companies are pushing. So it got a really bad rap there in the early days. But it was ultimately, and still is, a drug that can be used in combination with other effective treatments to suppress the virus. But a single drug alone cannot.
Yeah, that's amazing. It reminded me of an alien invasion. The way, you know, you'd stop something and then something else would seep through. And it's unbelievable. Now, of course, the devastation began to ebb with the advent of protease inhibitors and what we call the cocktail. So,
exactly.
So talk to us about that. Those drugs have been a miracle in some ways.
Specifically developed because of our knowledge of the virus and how the virus behaved and how the virus was formed, what its actual genetic makeup was. So these were drugs that were developed and came to be available to us in the mid-90s. And, you know, the studies were ongoing, and I think the first drugs were approved in about 1995, and we were starting to use these drugs and finding that they were effective. But it was really at the International Conference in Vancouver in 1996 that the first big paper was presented that really revealed the study of hundreds of patients who were on these drugs in combination therapy versus patients who were not on these drugs. And the results were so dramatic and so amazing.
Their virus
levels dropped to undetectable levels because now we could measure the virus. The T cell counts improved, so the immune systems recovered, and patients really went back to gaining their health. It was so amazing, having those studies really confirmed what we were seeing, you know, in small numbers of patients in our own clinics, but having those bigger studies really confirmed what we were seeing. So that was a very big transformation that time.
It was.
Oh my gosh, we really have treatment that's really going to work.
Oh, it was like a miracle. It still is in some ways. I know friends who've lived because of those cocktails. Your book talks so beautifully about some of the memorable patients that you worked with. Can you tell us about a couple of them that really come to mind? There's so many. Peaches, Olive, Etta, John, Timothy, you know. Which one would you like to talk to us a little bit about?
There were a lot. I think part of me, I wanted to write the book to remember so many of the patients I took care of. I guess I think of Bella, who was a woman. She and her husband both had AIDS from drug use, and they had two sons. One of the younger son was also born with HIV, and when he was diagnosed, that's what got the parents diagnosed. So suddenly, of the four people in the family, three of them had HIV, and the parents didn't want to tell the boys about the HIV. And Bella, the mother, she had quit drugs as soon as the diagnosis was made, and her husband struggled very tremendously. He felt so guilty and so terrible, and this just perpetuated his drug use, and he was really unable to leave the drugs behind. But Bella gave up drugs and really worked so hard to raise her kids, but she did not want them to know about the diagnosis. So the younger boy was in care and was just told that he had a blood condition. As the parents got sicker and sicker and in and out of the hospital, and it was so tragic, because Bella was just a lovely person. She was trying so hard to be a good mother, and, you know, here was her family just falling apart. And fortunately, she had a sister and her sister's husband, and that they really stepped in to help take care of the children before both parents died in about 1996. But she stands out in my mind as a person who, you know, she just had a number of terrible life events and life circumstances, and she got herself together, but it was really too late, and it was just heartbreaking because she loved her kids and her husband too. She just loved her family so much, and it was so sad to have this happen and to watch this happen.
Yeah, a lot of your stories about your patients are incredibly moving. What do you think gave you so much compassion? I know a lot of medical people probably thought these were throwaway people who were uneducated. You know, what gave you such compassion?
Well, you know, it's a person like Bella or you know, some of the other people that I wrote about, Peaches, who is so colorful. Mm-hmm. Our patients were incredible characters.
Yeah, you know, they were.
Some of them could be really frustrating or, infuriating, but some were just, they were funny and so brave, and some of them were really very noble, and they were a lot of times people who you might otherwise forget, you know. And I think if I was doing this job alone, it would have been very hard to sustain the compassion and the energy to do it. But I worked with a really dedicated team of people where the intensity of what we were going through and our work was really disseminated throughout the group, because I worked with nurses, I worked with other doctors, of course, and as well as nurses and social workers. We had a full-time chaplain. We had two psychiatrists. We had a nutritionist. So all this team approach, this multidisciplinary approach, really helped each and every one of us, you know, especially in the early days, in the early 90s, when it was great to be a doctor, but we weren't really necessarily changing anything that was happening with our patients. We could treat pneumocystis, but we couldn't treat the HIV. And so sometimes the social worker played the most important role, because they were able to get the patient's electricity turned back on, or get them to the food bank when they needed it, or help them get into a treatment care facility if they were struggling with drugs. So oftentimes those other disciplines were helping so much. And together as a team, it helped each of us, as well as really being super important for the patients. It was also helpful for each other, I would say.
Yeah, I love the whole model of that, because it seems to be missing in modern medicine. Everybody's got a specialist. No one knows what's happening. We don't have a GP anymore. So it's really interesting. Now, there does seem to be a resurgence of nonchalance about AIDS because of the advent of the cocktail and the drugs that seem to be working well. Are you concerned about that? I mean, people say, I don't have to use condoms because they have drugs for this now, you know?
This is a sad thing. I mean, I think it is one of the sad statistics in the United States is that really the number of new cases per year has not gone down in the last 20 years. With the protease inhibitors and with the advent of effective therapy, the actual number of new cases did fall. But really, we have over 40,000 new cases every year.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's really very unfortunate, because yes, we can treat this disease, and yes, we can make it a chronic illness, but not everybody gets into care, and not everybody wants to take medicine. And so there are still a lot of patients out there who are suffering and dying from HIV. And I think you're right. I think some of it is a little bit of nonchalance, and I think it's a failing on the overall responsibility that we have to educate people and to make sure that they are aware of the risk, because as the total pool of patients is growing because patients are living longer, that means that, you know, you just can't tell if somebody's got HIV from looking at them. And mm-hmm. so people need to be more thoughtful about the use of condoms in with their sexual partners, because there is that risk of transmission. And, you know, I think of people who say, you know, this, it's no big deal. You take some medicine and you're perfectly fine and healthy. But nobody who's a newly diagnosed patient in my office is happy to be there. Nobody wants to have HIV.
Yeah.
So it's really unfortunate that there are still so many new cases every year.
Yeah, I find it unfortunate too, the attitudes that I hear from especially younger gay men. Now, do you think there'll ever be a cure?
Well, you know, I used to be a little bit dubious about that because, you know, the virus, it can change so much, so its capacity to become resistant is real. And also, for patients who are on medicine, if they stop their medicine, there are always a few little latent viruses that are hiding out somewhere in the body that, as soon as the drugs are not on board anymore, those viruses become present. That's why patients need to take medicine forever. But more recently, there's been talk of trying to target the virus and target drugs that will activate those latent viruses and flush them out of their hiding places so that the effective treatments can work. And so I've been at a couple of conferences where people are realistically talking in a way where cure is, I think, within reach. I wouldn't say it's going to happen tomorrow, but it may happen in our lifetime that we see this cured. But it's been a real challenge. Ideally, it would be good to be able to prevent it more effectively, have a real a preventive vaccine. But that's been really, we've really struggled with that because the virus mutates so much. So finding a preventive vaccine has really been very disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And we only have about a minute left. Has the toll taken, has there been a toll on you personally? Do you ever get weary of being on the front lines of this still really bad disease?
Yeah, sure. There are definitely days that are tough when I still have patients who are struggling with this illness, and partly because of where they're coming from and the lives they're leading, which are complicated for so many other reasons with HIV on top of that. So there are definitely days when I feel that it's really tough. But again, I'm very, very lucky to have the team that I work with, and that really keeps me in it and keeps me interested and involved.
Great, great. Well, Dr. Susan Ball, do you have any contact information that people can use to get in touch?
Sure. I have a website with a link for the book, which is susanballmd.com, and they can also just find the book on Amazon or at the Cornell University Press website.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Ball. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great conversation. And again, your book is absolutely fabulous. I hope everybody will go out and read it.
Thank you so much, Tish.
The book is called Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Care Changed from Doom to Hopeful. Dr. Susan Ball, thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.